I don't care what people think anymore. I don't care if me not drinking means clients don't want to do business with me. And of course, thankfully, it was also the best thing I ever did for my broking career because it was a USP. I was the guy that didn't drink, the one guy that didn't drink. Then I went plant-based. So I always joke, I'd take my clients out. They'd just about get over the fact that I wasn't drinking. And this was before plant-based was a thing. And then there'd be any dietary requirements and I'd be like, I'm vegan. And it'd be like, well, if I'm going to blow up my clientele, I might as well do it in one big bang. But of course, it went the other way. They thought this was brilliant. And all of a sudden,
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. I'm super excited to have Andy Bramage today as my guest. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Andy is a former professional footballer who, after injury, created two major financial brokerages. After taking a break from alcohol, Andy's mind, body, career, and life were transformed. 10 years later, Andy is widely recognized as one of the world's leading performance coaches. Andy has written two best-selling books and appeared on the world's biggest stages and the top podcasts. The coaching initiatives that Andy has created have collectively helped hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, to transform their health. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Hi, Andy. Welcome to This Is Powerful. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I've been admiring what you're doing in the alcohol-free space, and the word marshmallows is never going to mean the same thing to me, but we'll get onto that a little later. I'd love to know more about you, Andy, where you're from and what your upbringing was like.
Yeah, so I guess I'll begin. We grew up, it sounds, in a similar area, in Dagenham, if you want to be posh.
I've heard that recently,
Dagenham. I loved it there, actually. I was all about football, so I was, you know, that kid that just loved his sport, went to a little primary school there called St. Teresa's, quite a working class, I guess, upbringing. Although my dad, his destiny was to go to Tate and Lyle in the docks, like all his cousins, ended up at 14 or 15 going into the city as a like the most basic office junior in reinsurance and ended up some 30, 40 years later as one of the big bosses.
Wow.
So our life started to change a little bit as he started to progress literally from the bottom towards the top in many ways. So we moved from Dagenham out to, we got all posh on ourselves and went to Romford.
Lovely.
Which is nice.
Everywhere east, everyone does well and goes east, don't they?
Just keep going eventually. And but I, you know, I had a brilliant childhood. It was all about like my BMX, playing football and playing a bit more football. I got two brothers who I love. We had a great time together. So I felt very fortunate. I definitely have had a really good childhood, if you know what I mean. There's nothing in there that, you know, that would get in the way of anything that's followed. I must admit, it was quite idyllic in many ways.
It's interesting when someone changes from, I know Tate and Lyle's as well, where it is, for those who don't know, it's a big sugar factory, isn't it, in East London?
Yeah.
And a lot of people would work there or they'd work in the docks or at Ford's.
Yeah.
So it's amazing when someone changes and gets out and it just changes, I think, the mindset. And did you notice the change in your dad as he grew into this new job?
Yeah, I mean, obviously our circumstances started to change, but I think it changed the narrative. Like for him, it was really brave to not follow all of his cousins and everyone did the same thing. And it was this risk almost to go into the city. So he sort of broke the mold like you suggested. So that opened our eyes up to, I think, opportunity. And, you know, myself and my older brother in particular, you know, having started in Dagenham, is now one of the biggest oil traders in the world. I mean, he's absolutely huge. So for a couple of lads out of Dagenham, we've sort of done... Sort
it's amazing though, isn't it? Because I always think it's not where you're born or where you're from, but it's what you do with the information that's fed to you or desire and stuff. With football, I was a footballer. Horrendous.
Right.
I did get a couple of medals for playing in defence. You turned professional. How did that come around after playing as a kid, enjoying the football? Because that's quite a journey to get to be an elite professional footballer, right?
Yeah, I mean, I signed with Leyton Orient, not far from here, when I was 10. So that path was pretty much mapped out for me. Although I went to a rugby playing school in Upminster called Campion. So they didn't play football.
Yeah, I know.
It was a great school for me to go to, but there was no football played, so I just played rugby. So I actually found myself in a bit of a strange situation. I was playing football on the side almost, whereas most of the other kids would have been playing football through school and all the district and all that. I did none of that because I just wasn't involved in it. I played rugby. And in truth, I was probably better at rugby than I was at football. So I was one of them. I had like the heart of a lion, but the control and technique of Bambi. Do you know what I mean? On ice. So I had that sort of power about me and that willing to win and all those things. But technically, I wasn't good enough, in truth.
You knew that then, or are you saying that
I
from
sort now? Of knew that then. And when I stepped into the full-time arena, so I had a nice choice. I had leave school at 16 and pursue the dream of being a professional footballer. Staying at school, which I really enjoyed, A-levels, take my rugby as far as I could go, maybe degrees. Rugby wasn't really, well, it wasn't. It was an amateur sport back then. Yeah. I chose football because I loved it. And really quickly found I was in a man's world. It is a man's world. At 16, there was no mucking around. Like, I was a threat to the more senior players. It was some of the enjoyment went at that stage, I must admit.
When you say a man's world, for our listeners, what does it actually mean?
So what I mean by that is, I look at my daughter now, 16, she still seems so young. I was still so young. I mean, I'm not just turned 16. And instantly it was like, you are fighting for your position. You know, you win or lose, you're in the team, you're out of the team. If you're training with the first team, they're not taking it easy on you because you're a 16-year-old. You're going to get hit just as hard as the mature, you know, athlete who's in their 30s. So it really woke me up quickly to where I was at my level, and I was miles behind, technically. But a bit like yourself, I did something that probably most footballers have never done at that age, certainly. I started to read books. Lots of them.
That's books. Really unusual.
Philosophy. I read books on self-development. I read biographies. And I started to think differently and act differently because I knew technically I was too far behind. So I started to train differently. I would train all the time when everyone else went home, up against the wall. I'd come home, train over the park, even though I was a professional footballer, with my brother over at Rafael's Park to just drill the skill to try and get my technique where it needed to be.
Who suggested about reading? How did that come around?
I don't actually know. I don't think there was a triggering moment. I think it was more the sense that I knew I had to do something different because technically I was too far behind. So I always had a love of learning. I enjoyed reading. So I think I just followed that passion and it opened me up to loads of different insights. It definitely started to change me as a person from a really young age. I started to see the world a little bit differently. I started to realize that if you want to get different results, you've got to try different things.
Yeah.
And I realized if I just followed the system, I was going to get bailed out. And the truth is, I rose up through the ranks at Leyton Orient. And at that moment where you get offered a professional contract or not, it was literally like, you know, Pop Idol or one of those where we queued up outside the manager's office. 20 of us, imagine.
No pressure. What a way to do it.
I mean, what a way to do it. You're either like dreams were made or your heart was broken. There was no in between.
And there was no looking after you after, I would imagine.
No. So I joined that queue. Out of the 20, only two lads got a professional contract. I wasn't one of them. So my heart was broken at that point. Totally devastated, right? Everything I'd worked to from the age of 10. And I was just starting to get my momentum. I was starting to catch up technically and I was starting to think different, actually different. And instead of giving up though, this is the difference. And I think these are the difference that reading did for me anyway. I started to think I've got a choice, what I believe. There's a quote that has changed my life and it will live with me forever. And it's from Epictetus. And I'm going to paraphrase it from 2000 years ago, the great Stoic philosopher.
Yep.
It's not the events that shape our lives, but our beliefs about them.
Yeah.
So I knew in that moment I had a choice, what I could believe. I could believe I'm not good enough, which most of the lads did. I give up. What's the point? Which almost all of the lads did. Or actually, I'm going to prove you wrong. I think I'm just starting to gain my momentum as a footballer. So I went out on trial and really quickly, Gillingham came in for me, offered me a pro contract. And really quickly, I was in the first team.
Wow.
So, and then really quickly, I'd scored my first goal in the Football League, which was my dream. That's all I ever wanted to do. Didn't care who it was for or what happened or what the goal was like. It wasn't a very good one, in truth.
It went in.
But it went in. I sort of joked. I deliberately mishit it and the bobble sent the keeper the wrong way. But like, I did it. Yeah. Went on some mad knees up celebration and I'd achieved that goal. And that was then, you can imagine, that solidified in my brain. My approach of being different and thinking different, my approach of choosing a better belief got me a result that all those other boys didn't get. Yet they were better than me, many of them, but they never, ever made it to that level.
That's interesting because I it was the same with me for modelling. There was a lot of better looking fellas, better bodies, and whatever they had, but I chose to work harder and really hone my skills. My first job in the States, I was 21, and I worked with two really good guys. Actually, was the only models I'd ever seen before, and I worked with them. And I was actually humble enough to say, I don't know what I'm doing. Can I just follow you guys? And they're like, yeah, of course. And it just took away any, because you always used to take Mickey out of younger guys who come in, and there was always that kind of boisterous thing. But I think because I asked sincerely, these guys were like, yeah, come, we'll show you what we did. And I learned what they did. And then I tried to look for the bits that was probably missing. And what I realized, a lot of people get, maybe like football, there's certain moves you do, there's certain shapes you do as a model. And there's a joke about it, like catalog page 30 is that shape and this shape. But actually it's all the bits in between that count. Because what a lot of photographers want is the story in between, the movement, the bit where you're not posing and you're not caught. It's actually what's going on for you. There's an artistic side to it. And I really, really honed in on that. And that made a difference for me.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, it shows you, doesn't it? I think in life, in many ways, if you can think differently outside the box very often and try different things, you get different results.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't see that. They're too quick to give up because that event that shapes their life, often that belief that follows is a limiting one.
See, I really believe that, like, limiting beliefs, when you're younger, I think that's so unique what you said. Someone, for me, early, if you're not reading, someone has to say something around me. So I wasn't reading early. I was dyslexic. And my limiting belief was, well, I can't read. I'm not good enough. I've seen what the teacher says. It's not worth it. I get a really uncomfortable, anxious feeling about it. And that was my belief. And that stopped me from reading for a long time. When I picked up books and I started to read, I read, first book I read was an SAS book because I was interested in soldiers and stuff. And I read it all the way through and I was so encouraged about what they're doing, their mindset, how the hell do you land somewhere, how do you get out, what goes on, that I realised that I've just read a book really easily. That was actually very enjoyable. So that was a little moment for me to just change and go, okay, now I'm on tap to read what I want to read.
Yeah, it just shows you, doesn't it? I think reading is a super skill. Whether you listen to podcasts or you listen to audiobooks or you read, I think it is a master skill.
100%. And it's something, there wasn't many people reading books in my family, immediate family. And we've changed that for our kids now. We've got like a little library and we all sit there and read books and they love it. I love it. And we have a nice time. So what age were you at Gillingham?
So I was there 19 till 21 and then got injured. Classically, just when things were getting exciting. So there I was again faced with this huge event in my life. My career was over.
Was that in a match you got
effectively
injured?
It was in training and then it was basically a small injury that I played on that ended my career. It was a cartilage tear, which is a nothing kind of injury.
Painful.
But I kept playing. I didn't tell anyone. So I made that classic error and then damaged all the bones, which was like arthritis. Then I just couldn't train.
Did you not tell anyone at the time because you thought if I tell them, maybe I'm out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Classic, you know, young mistake. And I could sort of play through it, but I was taking big Brufen tablets, which I should not have been taking. I kept it to myself. My knee was swelling up like a balloon. I was doing so well. I didn't want to break the chain of that perceived success. And unfortunately, I basically did myself in. So by the time I finally got it operated on, the guy gave me 1 or 2 years.
When you say perceived success, was that what other people were thinking of you or what you'd thought?
A bit of both, actually. Yeah. I think I didn't want to lose that momentum of not being in the team because it just felt like if I fell out of the team, I wouldn't get back in type of thing. I think I felt vulnerable. I didn't have that confidence yet in myself shining through. So I ended up basically ending my own career in many ways. You could look at it that way. Had I been brave enough to sort of stop and get it looked at, it would have been a nothing injury. But, you know, the rest is history.
No, but it is, but that's really important because people don't know that. When you're young, you don't know that. I used to box and I broke this knuckle plenty of times. And I would carry on and just carry on and carry on. Now I have a little bit of arthritis from it. But it's interesting because stuff like what you do in conversation we have, I think it's really important because it takes one sentence for a young person to hear and go, actually, yeah, I've got that at the moment. Maybe I should have a look at it. And then you're going for a long-term gain rather than a short-term gain, aren't you?
Yeah, really important. My daughter's a ballerina. So I had the same conversation with her because you see it in ballet all the time, because the prima ballerina is one as opposed to 11 on a football team. Therefore, they are even more fearful to show any weakness. So very often you see it in that environment. Lots of them carry these terrible injuries that finishes their careers early for the same reason. So yeah, it's nice to be able to pass that wisdom on.
Yes, it is really important. So you go from there to being a broker. Was that a long transition? How did that happen?
It was quite a long one, actually. So what happened, I ended up in Ireland, funnily enough. I sort of limped over to Ireland. Although my professional career was over, I went over there and played a bit of football. It was part-time, so it facilitated that. And I loved it. Fell in love with Ireland, fell in love with the Irish people, fell in love with an Irish girl, as you do. And then just sort of bummed around. I didn't really do a lot. I was working in IT. It wasn't really anything that was lighting me up. I was just earning enough money to go out and drink and have fun.
And play football at the time. So was that hanging on to the... Was it hanging on to what it meant to you at one point?
It was sort of over. My career was finished. I was done as a professional. I couldn't train, as mentioned. So obviously I had the skill to play football, but it sort of limped along. It only lasted a couple of years over there. I knew I was done anyway. And then it was gone. But I stayed in Ireland because I loved it there.
Yeah.
And then had about 4 or 5 years there and then went traveling with my wife, Australia, basically all around the world, which I loved. And we were going to stay in Australia. I got a good job out there in IT. We were going to, you know, spend the rest of our lives there. And then we went to New Zealand one day and it was cold and it was rainy and the pubs had fires on. And we were like, should we go home? And we literally had one of those moments. Yeah. Came back to London. I was never meant to fall into broking. I was going to go to Ireland. And it just so happens my brother had become one of the biggest traders in the oil market. He'd been working really hard while I'd been basically having a good time.
Yeah.
So as big brothers do, he got me a job. On the floor, the broken floor, the pits, the guys who, you know, bright jackets, buy, sell.
Yeah.
He thought I'd be really good at it. And he was sort of right.
How old was you then?
I was about 27, 28. And I had the shirt on my back. And I tell this story a lot. I now work with lots of professional athletes, professional footballers with the Professional Footballers Association on transitioning their career. But I always tell them that story because I'll meet a lot of athletes at age 28 or 30 and they're coming to the end of their career or their career's ended for injury. And they're like, it's too late. It's over. And I'm like, I didn't even start my real professional career till I was 28 years old. It's the truth of it. I had to shout my back at that point. But once I did, and I connected with that thing that I was good at and could utilize all those skills from being an athlete, you know, that bounce back ability, that resilience, that teamwork, that discipline, that courage, I excelled really quickly in that environment. You know, fast forward 10 years, I'd gone from a junior, so I had to start again at 28. That's hard when you're 28 to start at the bottom. I was the boss, almost a bit similar to what my dad had done. You know, we had offices in New York, Houston, Singapore, you know, all over the world, built a global broken franchise in many ways and achieved, you know, that material success.
And Merv moved further east.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you do. Then moved to Shenfield, as you do. And then, you know, expecting to be blissfully happy, as the conventional wisdom tells you, doesn't it? Earn enough money. I had one yardstick money. That was it.
It's literally... I don't know what goes on now on younger kids, but that is literally it. It's it. Once you get the house, the car, the wife, everything, and the big bank account or investments, then you'll be happy.
How's that going for everyone?
It's just not, when I got there for me, first time was at 28, 29. And I have never been so unhappy in my life because I worked obsessively for 8 years at least. And I just... never stayed in one country, and I was just knocking on doors, walking, doing the stuff, trying to improve. And it was like, it was very healthy. It saved me from alcohol for a long time. And then around that time, I was living between Miami and New York, and I started to put my feet up. And when I started to put my feet up, the beer come in, the partying come in, the ladies come in. I just started to feel like I deserve stuff on some sort of level and I'm going to enjoy it. And that happened, that change happened really, really, really quickly. And when you become successful in that field, how did alcohol come in for you?
I think it was part of the job initially. And I always liked a beer and I was the sort of larger than life entertainer kind of person, you know, and I started drinking when I was 13. Probably like yourself or lots of people do anyway, certainly where I grew up. And it was definitely a bit of a coping strategy for feeling a bit awkward and a bit uncomfortable about talking to girls.
Yeah.
So I could drink this elixir and then da-da, it was easy.
Hmm.
We'd go to the Academy under-18s disco at Romford, which I loved, and we all would go
you
in
must
there.
Must have seen you there at some
yeah,
point.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder if you were in there.
And Hollywood.
And then Hollywood. I matured into Hollywood as we went on. And it was, you know, for me, it did the trick, right? Mm. So my little brain at 13 would have lit up like a Christmas tree in Semple. That was bloody good. You were suffering that anxiety about talking to girls. You drunk that liquid and da-da, that's magic.
And is that in hindsight, or did that actually happen then?
That's in hindsight, my reflection in hindsight. But I know my brain was lighting up because it was a big thing for me. And I wanted to meet girls and all that. And I found it easy. And obviously that young brain, it's only 13-year-old brain in the face of that pretty powerful drug, hasn't got a lot of chance in many ways. So I think mine was a lot of misadventure ever since. I think I built that limiting belief about alcohol, and that followed me everywhere. So if I was going out socially, I'd always have a drink because I wanted to become that person.
Yeah.
And actually what I didn't realize until I stopped drinking that I was always quite introverted. And I am, by nature, I'm quite introverted. I love to read. I love solitude. I like time on my own. And alcohol made me into an extrovert in many ways, a sort of flamboyant, larger-than-life character that wasn't me. It was a lie in many ways. So through that process of, again, just enjoying myself or perceived enjoying myself, I had some brilliant times. I never looked back with regret. It was also part of the job. Being a broker, you got a magic card, so a credit card. You could go anywhere, any restaurant, any pub, whatever you want. It was all on the card. So that was just kid in a candy shop for the best part of 10 years, entertaining clients, traveling all over the world, doing all that kind of stuff.
Was there any points where you thought, I started lacing you 15 and had a really horrible experience early on, but used alcohol for the same thing? Definitely for confidence, definitely to fit in. I'm an introvert as well. A lot of people would disagree, probably with yourself,
because
you've got such a great outward personality. But it just, same identification with that of just made me be able to walk into a room and not think, I wonder what if they're talking about me, or I wonder if this girl's going to knock me back, or whatever it would have been at the time. And it became an armor and a shield, which I didn't realize until I looked back at it, that I needed that to socialize, I needed that at work. And in my environment, it was the same. Everyone drunk, there was always champagne on the table at work, and it was just a normal thing. And that's for me where I didn't look at myself early on and think, it's quite abnormal to drink champagne at 11 o'clock in the middle of work. Was that similar?
Yeah, there was moments where I just thought, this is not serving me anymore, really. It just become, and I think in truth, looking around at my peers, I wasn't drinking any more than anyone else.
Yeah.
But we're all drinking too much.
Yeah.
And the truth is, who isn't drinking too much? Every celebration, commiseration, I had the added, I guess, excuse that I could entertain clients as well. So that meant there was a bit more midweek action for me. But the truth is, at the weekend, I wouldn't really drink unless I had to.
Yeah.
Because I was tired from it and I'd had enough of it. And when I was with my lovely wife or the kids, I didn't need it. So I was having that sort of weird moment of, hold on, what is this serving me anymore? You know, I classed myself as a middle lane drinker, someone that was very capable of drinking heavily, averagely, moderately, not at all. There's no rock bottom in my story. There was no problem as such. No one told me to stop drinking. In fact, the very opposite in my story. You know, when I decided to take a break, one of my big mentors in the industry said, if you continue to not drink, you're finished, right? No client's going to want to go out with a broker that doesn't drink.
I was told the same, and a lot of business deals and a lot of stuff in my industry was done over dinner as well. It's very insightful for you to see that it's not serving you, because a lot of people miss that. So I was going to ask this later on, but what is a middle lane drinker?
Yeah, so again, just define that. Really, it's everyone that drinks in between those that are in recovery, for example, and those that are abstinent. Everyone, therefore, is in the middle lane.
Yeah.
It's a gradient of
which
a middle lane.
Which is a huge part of the market, right?
Yeah. It's just massive, and it's been largely ignored. I think all the focus, and rightly so, has been on those in recovery, which is a really important
space. Well, some people have crossed the line to alcoholism and addiction and do need to be abstinent.
Yeah, and that whole middle lane, it wasn't a thing. So when I looked at this over 10 years ago, and I was having that moment of reflection, is this serving me? I found it really difficult because I looked around and thought, but I haven't got a problem.
Mm.
So why would I stop? And all of the sort of cultural messages were saying the same. It was like, well, you either don't drink because you've got a problem, and if you haven't, you drink, right? Why would anyone ever stop proactively?
Which is so in reverse, isn't it? It's literally, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you drinking? And then people used to say, well, I don't have a problem. And I'm like, I didn't ask. You don't look like you have a problem.
It's nuts.
So when you first stopped, what did you experience? And did you experience enough to say, yeah, I'm right thinking about alcohol doesn't serve me anymore? And how long was that process?
It was messy. And I think change is messy for people in general. It was probably a good 2 years from awareness to actually taking affirmative action, i.e. taking a break.
Yeah.
I would look at it, think about it, start to notice how I felt. Anxiety was starting to kick in for me in a big way, to full-blown panic attacks some days after, you know, if it had been a big enough drinking session in many ways.
It really messes with your nervous system.
Oh, it's horrible. Like, that is horrific. Anyway, if anyone's experienced that, that was horrific, that part of it.
Yeah.
It was really affecting my confidence. I started to see this. So we talk about this in the stages of change model, Prochaska's great stages of change model. You go from pre-contemplation, which is a sort of unawareness, into awareness. I'd stepped into that awareness, and the research also backs it up. Very often it takes people about 2 years to start taking action. So I was looking at it thinking, you know, scratching my head going, maybe it is this alcohol thing, but it can't be. Can't be alcohol. You know, that kind of,
100%,
I tried everything. I was running again. I was trying to eat better. I was meditating. I was ice bathing. But never the alcohol thing was like, well, I can't really question that bit because that's like who I am, right?
And normal and part of
and
life.
And part of everything. How I do business and why, you know, we've got a nice home and all these type of things. So it took a long while to be brave enough to challenge that thinking. And then I decided to take a break. And I told a few people about it. And they all laughed and went, never in a million years.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way you'll even do a week, let alone a month, because I was that guy, right? I painted myself into that corner
of
being.
Which is a good fuel to take on board, though, isn't it?
It is, because it pissed me off. It pissed me off. One guy in particular who I used to work with really pissed me off. He went, you never do it. And he was so dismissive, uncompetitive. I was like, I'm going to fucking prove you wrong. And of course, I didn't. I slipped up. You know, and I had to suffer that, you know, and he knew I slipped up.
What did you say? To slip up, you had to set a goal. What was your goal that you said to him?
Was to do a month. That's all I started with. But I was out with clients, you know, once a week. So I was instantly back in the lion's den. It wasn't like I could just hide away for a month. I was like straight out of a client who in their mind would see me as the larger than life guy. And therefore, why wouldn't I want to entertain them? What was wrong with them as to why I didn't want to drink? So I slipped up within, you know, a couple of weeks. They all laughed. That particular colleague really laughed, which really pissed me off. And I thought, maybe there's another strategy. So then I started watering the plants and pretending to drink when I wasn't drinking because I couldn't get past the social pressure. There was no alcohol-free alternatives really back
then. There was a couple of really bad things.
Becks, about. But very poorly stocked if you could find it anywhere. So I decided to water the plants. And then what happened was I actually built up a month, well, 28 days to be exact, where actually I didn't drink. And it was massive for me because I started to really experience what it would be like to be alcohol free. I started to get my time back, my confidence started to come back, my mental health started to come back, that clarity. I was like, I think there's something in this for me. And that was magical because I knew I was on the right path. And what actually happened quite soon after that, I ended up quitting that job. And everyone said, you cannot leave this job. You've built the like massive broken franchise. You can't leave it. But what I knew, and I was gaining all this sort of momentum in my life around being alcohol free. I just reread Anthony Robbins' Awaken the Giant Within, classic self-help, which I loved.
Yep.
Really started to fill my mind with new ideas. I started to think there's more to this life than meets the eyes. A bit like yourself, I had a moment of reflection where I looked around at those people more successful than me and my one yardstick, which was money. So those that have made more money in my industry, all I saw was broken bodies, broken minds, broken homes.
Mm.
I was like, do you know what? That's not it. That can't be it. What are we all doing? So I had all this massive moment of reflection going on.
It's a massive awakening on, I mean, he's already smart and present anyway, but that's another level, isn't it? To look around you at your peers and just think, oh my God, like see it as it really is. That's not the answer. This isn't it. They're not what I thought would have been.
Yeah, and I had young kids at the time and I could see the writing on the wall. I could see the classic writing on the wall.
Mm.
Really wealthy, broker, marriage broken, you know, kids estranged, dead.
Yeah.
From a heart attack, from the life that I was living. You know, I could see it.
Yeah.
I was like, what's the point in that? Stick your money up your ass. I've got, do you know what? I don't care. So I'd reached this really empowered place and it needed me to look at the alcohol thing to get that courage back again. So I decided to leave that job. And I loved, they all loved, you know, I was the sort of a bit the golden child there. I'd done really well and really loved a lot of the people there. I really did. But I knew I had to leave to escape that identity and start again, which I never wanted to do, but I knew I had to do it and it took a lot of courage to do it. And everyone said, you're mad. So that gave me a year off, gardening leave. So
and did you plan that to do anything, or was it just, let me get out of here because this is not serving me and see what happens?
Yeah, I basically done a deal with another firm. I was going to set up my own franchise effectively. Yeah. So it was quite a bold move in terms of business, but also I knew it was going to give me some time. It gave me a year fully paid because gardening leave. And I used that year really well. Traveled the world, you know, to get in front of the big thought leaders and thinkers. I trained as a coach, an executive coach with a guy called John Grinder.
I know John Grinder, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry to stop you, but did you search out people like Grinder and just go, shall I do, say, Anthony Robbins course or other courses? Did you really find that you wanted to search for, that doesn't mean anything to me anymore, what does mean to me and how do I get there? Was that the kind of search?
Absolutely.
Or?
It was, there's more to this life than meets the eyes. That path is not serving me. I don't know where this is going to take me. So I read Anthony Robbins' book and he mentioned John Grinder in it several times, that John Grinder trained Anthony Robbins. So my mind was like, well, can I train with the guy that trained Anthony Robbins? That's the gift. Now, I thought I was going to have to pay hundreds of thousands of pounds and fly to LA. And I remember searching and it was John Grinder, next course, Croydon.
No way.
Like, Croydon. The last place in a million years I thought I'm going to see John Grinder was in Croydon. And it was an executive coaching NLP practitioner course. Yeah. I was like, that's a gift. I'm going to go and do that. I knew nothing about coaching. I knew nothing about neuro-linguistic programming. I just wanted to get in the room with this guy and see what happens. So I went and did this training. It was like 10 days straight with John Grinder. And it was brilliant. I'd never experienced anything like it. Totally different people to me. I was the only sort of brokery type there, as you can imagine. And there were so many moments where I thought to myself, if my mates could see me now, we are doing some wacky, weird stuff here. But I loved it. It started to change my mind in every which way. I started to understand about mindfulness, even though they didn't talk about mindfulness, being present. I started to understand how to break down limiting beliefs. I had no idea. Yeah. I thought everything in my mind must be the truth.
Yeah.
Because it's in my mind. And then realized actually 99.9% of it is total bullshit and made up and not even true.
Best thing someone said to me is, you're not your thinking.
Yeah.
It's like, really?
I was like, oh, didn't know that was a thing. And I'd obviously built a lot of this momentum in my earlier years, but never really pursued it. And now it was all just clicking into place. It was like my brain was just on fire with this stuff. It was like, wow, this is transformative. So that gained me momentum. I then eventually wanted to go back and learn about coaching and coaching philosophy. I ended up going back to do a degree because I left school at 16.
Where did you go to do that?
Open University, which I loved and can't recommend enough.
Yeah.
And my footballers union had funded some of that, the PFA, in my earlier years. So I topped it up. But that gave me leverage to do a master's degree in positive psychology and coaching psychology.
How long did that take you to do that whole
thing? That whole thing took me about 6 or 7 years in total.
Wow.
I blooming loved every second of it. I ended up passing that distinction. That all sort of was part of the story as it was unfolding as it was. So I fell in love with the process, fell in love with coaching. Never thought that was going to be a thing.
Yeah.
Decided, right, I'm going to go and change my life. I want to follow this passion. But I just signed a whopping great big deal for 5 years. To start this new broken franchise.
So how did that happen then? Because that's a massive deal, like you just said. And then obviously this thing's over passionate over that. So how did you work both?
So in many ways, economically, it would have been extremely risky to have walked away from that and just pursued this dream. So I just thought, right, how can I just leverage all of this learning and bring it into broken? Rather than run away to a monastery somewhere and try and figure it out, can I bring it to the eye of the storm? And will it work in that arena? So given all this learning that I'd got, I was like, you know, I'm going to go back. I'm going to set up a brokerage different. I'm going to eat salad and stuff. I'm not going to drink. And of course, I get back into it and I'm 3 months into it. I'm entertaining clients and I'm drinking again.
Yeah.
You know, with all of this momentum, all of this learning, you know, and I like to share that. It's important that people hear it because the truth is, it's rarely this beautiful linear story of change. There's lots of bumps in the road. But what had happened, I built all this beautiful momentum over that time off and not really drinking at all to think, no, actually, I don't care if this business fails anymore. I'm doing it the right way. So I quit alcohol. That was a massive door opener. I built a gym in the office. One of my good mates, a guy called Christian Daly, is ex-West Ham captain, Scotland captain. We dropped the dress code. So no dress code. Instead of suits, it was like joggers and bottoms. We just looked like a group of unfit personal trainers going to work every day. Built a gym, so we were deadlifting and doing deals.
That's amazing.
I had the lads dancing on the hour every hour. I'd set off an alarm. We brought energy back into the room.
Did they think, what the hell is this? Or were they like, this is...
They bought into it. You know, their number one song, right? Because it turned from just a bit of music to a song. I'd get them moving on the hour every hour. It was a big thing. I'd get them all to stand up and move. Their number one song, YMCA.
That's amazing.
So you've got all these big burly brokers rocking out to YMCA. And we flew. The business flew. Yeah. When everyone said my business would fail, I was on the ball 100% of the time, banging the drum, fitter and faster. I lost 3 stone in weight. My body fat went from 68 back down to athlete again, 42.
Wow.
I reached my old fighting weight of 12 stone 10. I never thought I'd ever see that again.
That's pretty epic.
Yeah. Like loving life. My relationships blossomed, my wife and my girls. I mean, it was so transformative in every domain of my life. I was doing the thing that I thought was impossible to do and flourish and thrive,
yeah,
and flourishing and thriving and being successful in that arena. And I used all of those coaching skills to coach my teams. So they were overcoming their limiting beliefs. I started to understand my own limiting beliefs in terms of working with clients. So the business just boomed. It grew 7 times bigger in half of the time of my previous business.
Amazing.
I absolutely loved it. And I thought, I've got to share this with other people. So this new wave of contributions sort of washed over me in many ways. It was never meant to be a thing. It just sort of started to happen.
Before we continue, I want to tell you about a podcast I was recently on, and I love listening to it as well. I featured on this last week, and it was a great experience for me to be on. Now, have you ever heard of a sliding door moment, a decision or an opportunity that could have gone either way that leads to two very different futures? Everybody has a sliding door moment in their lives, and they don't have to be big, don't have to be flashy, don't have to be incredible, but they can send someone down a unique path that you never expected. And I definitely had my fair share. Sliding Doors is the podcast that delves into the decisions and the moments that shape our lives. From Olympians to presenters, actors to entrepreneurs, and even people who cast in movies. In each episode, Jenny Becker chats to amazing people and asks them what could have been if they'd have chosen a different path. Join her each week, helping guests join the dots on small decisions or moments that have made a big difference and built the path of their lives. I'd highly recommend giving it a listen and thinking about your own sliding door moments. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. For you to learn all those things, then go back to drinking that one time, was that peer pressure? And did that fuel you to say, do you know what? I'm going to do it my way. Everyone's going to do it how I want to do it. And through the successes of that.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes we know this through the research as well. When people make big life changes, decisions, behavioral changes, slip ups, stumbles, they're part of the process.
Yeah.
And I think that's something really important to own as well as we move into this, that, you know, that is a very natural part of change rather than something to be ashamed of or embarrassed about. So I used the power of that in the end. It was like I slipped up. It reminded me of everything that I didn't want. I don't care what people think anymore. I don't care if me not drinking means clients don't want to do business with me.
Hmm.
I'm doing it on my terms. So I think that gave me the fuel to be that vanguard. And of course, thankfully, it was also the best thing I ever did for my broking career because it was a USP. I was the guy that didn't drink, the one guy that didn't drink. Then I went plant-based. So I always joke, I'd take my clients out. They'd just about get over the fact that I wasn't drinking. And this was before plant-based was a thing. And then there'd be any dietary requirements and I'd be like, I'm vegan. And it'd be like, well, if I'm going to blow up my clientele, I might as well do it in one big bang. But of course, it went the other way. They all thought this was hilarious. They thought this was brilliant. And all of a sudden, I started to find other clients that didn't really like to drink and didn't want to get caught up in the hype. I'd take them surfing for the weekend, Barry's boot camp, yoga. I had to find different ways to connect and socialize. So I built a bigger clientele and I was always on the bloody ball. I was 10 times better at the actual job, which of course, clients really appreciate as well.
This is really important because it's the same with me in my business. I was always early, left the latest, always there of service to help other people and was really on my game. So I stopped modeling. I actually went into a treatment center because I was quite bad in the end. And then when I'd made the decision and the belief that I can do this and it's better, and it's going to be better and brighter. And I went back to when I said earlier about the young kid that was full of vitality and really interested in life. I was like, how do I get that back? And from doing similar things to what you did, I got that back. And then it was weird because I felt I can't go back to the fashion business because everyone's drinking over lunch or smoking or doing whatever they're doing. How am I going to associate with these people? What the hell? And I always share this. One of my first jobs, I was having my hair done and the lady said something and I recognized it. I was like, are you a sober person? Like, do you drink? She goes, no. She goes, I'm off for like 3 or 4 years, whatever it was at the time. And I was like, no way. I thought she was a crazy person because she was so loud, yeah, outgoing and funny. There's no way she could be sober. Then I've met someone else the same. Then all of a sudden I met all these people that I thought were, they've got to be on something or drinking because they're just full of confidence and they're fun and they've got the most energy on the job. And I just found this new life. And actually there's a lot of people, when you start to ask people about drinking, if they're really honest, a lot of them are like, I actually don't really want to drink, but I feel like I've got to because of all the reasons you said. The same in my business. I think it's really important, and you probably teach all this anyway, that just doesn't matter. And when you change something, so many people put their hand up and say, I actually want to be part of that.
Yeah, and it's like goal setting or manifesting.
Yeah.
Like our brain can't take in all the information that's given to us for all the different inputs. Therefore, it has to filter on a goal or it has to filter on emotion.
Yeah.
So what I believe is all around us, especially now, there are loads of people not drinking. But when you're drinking, you don't see them. You don't notice them. You wouldn't have noticed that hairdresser. It would have just gone out, you know,
yeah,
water off a duck's back. All of a sudden, you go alcohol free. I was finding clients that didn't drink, mates that didn't drink, inspiring people that didn't drink, heroes that I would find, role models that didn't drink. They're always there.
Mm.
I just need to turn that awareness on. And once I did, that momentum that I gained was just unbelievable. It was like a superpower. I liken it to a superpower. I really believe that. For the average drinker to remove alcohol for a period of time and get back to your real self. Like, here's a good analogy. I always say this to people. If you think about it, when we drink, we become someone that we're not. We become a fake version of ourselves. I certainly did. I turned into someone that I wasn't. The research shows now it takes 5 days to recover from 2 or more drinks. 5 days.
Mm.
So you become a lesser person of yourself for 5 days, anxious, tired, grumpy, short-tempered, whatever it might be. And then, of course, if you drink within those 5 days, you become a fake version of yourself again, and then you recover again for 5 days. So when you look at a lot of people, myself included, I was never ever myself.
Yeah,
I'd spent decades not being me, my authentic self. There is so much power in showing up to life as you, as your authentic self. There's an energy that comes from that. There's a resilience and a power that comes from that that's really attractive, and barely anyone is standing in their shoes of their real self because of their average relationship with alcohol.
It's interesting. Like I said, I love what you're doing. I admire what you're doing because I came from the heavy end of addiction and I completely blew myself to bits. There was points where, and the initial thing for me was really to belong. I know we spoke about confidence and gives you this thing, but alcohol takes that all away. Like you said eloquently about you're not yourself. I didn't want to be myself because I was scared of stuff. I had some trauma and stuff as a kid. So being in the extreme in that thing, I was too scared of being myself because I didn't know who I was. But the abstinence part is really important because that just takes the lid off and the mask off to allow you to see who you are. And I always say, I don't know why I was so scared because I'm here anyway in this body. So what am I scared of? And I find that in the extreme of it, not in the middle lane, that most people are too scared to stop because they don't know who they are. They've got shame and guilt and stuff like that. But even for them, once they stop drinking, then it's an open field to then learn and address if you have stuff that you need to address before you move on, to see the highlights of being either a sober person or alcohol-free person.
Yeah, I've really changed my stance on this. I believe everyone, and that is everyone, and that includes all of that middle lane, that 70% of the adult population, should at some point in their life take a long break from alcohol to find out who they really are.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they do. I don't think they know. And there might be trauma there. There might be things that need to be addressed, but better to address those as authentically you. And if that work helps with those things, the power that you gain from that, the confidence that you gain from that, rather than constantly living this version that's just not you.
Yeah.
Not you when you drink, and not you when you recover, not you when you drink, and just that yo-yo thing.
Yeah.
Like stepping into that power of resilience, dealing with life's ups and their downs, the confidence that comes from that, being able to step into a room, go to a wedding, whatever it is your big challenges are, and not drink, and be introverted. If you're introverted, brilliant, but still shine in that body of your authentic self. There's something really powerful about that. That's what I've noticed that's been my biggest, I think, you know, insight, is that when you really step into your authentic self, there's an energy that other people find attractive, that you show up and shine with, that you can just waltz into anywhere. You don't have to live this constant concern of, oh, I need to have a drink or not have a drink or a celebration. Yeah. It's just gone.
It's such a brilliant way of putting it. I've found out as well over my period of time where I'll walk in somewhere and I'll feel shy. I know why I feel shy. Actually, it's not shy, it's self-conscious. Worrying about people I've put on a pedestal, what they'll say. So I'll just go up and I'll literally, they're like, how are you? I'm like, I'm a bit, feeling a bit shy, but you know, and it just breaks this barrier. Like, you're not shy. Oh, I am shy, but you know, and then we just go on these beautiful conversations.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I made a better friend out of someone. It's really empowering, to be honest. Obviously you don't want to walk in a bar or a rowdy place and go, I'm feel introverted today, that's probably not the best place to do it. But you're right, when you stand in your authentic self, there is this light, and I can see it in you just shining, that goes when you drink, because you're hiding, aren't you? You're trying to be somewhere and you're not present because you're trying to keep up this appearance of what you think someone else wants.
Yeah, and I think that, again, just adds to this momentum of being alcohol-free. I think for so many people to take a break and connect with that, and then what follows for many people is magical.
Yeah.
In many ways, you know, whether it be they start to get more consistent in the way they exercise and nourish their body, their temperament. I mean, how many people right now are suffering with anxiety, panic attacks, thinking their mental health is really starting to suffer, and unbeknownst to them, it's alcohol. Yeah. It's alcohol that's causing it, and the knock-on consequences of it disrupting their neurochemistry, and they're being overstimulated in GABA and then glutamate, and then it leaves them feeling anxious, worrying that they're getting the mental health issues, and actually a break from alcohol would solve it.
Yeah.
Or people that, you know, would like their skin to glow, and a break from alcohol would solve it. I mean, it's just, when you sort of see it, and I do own this as well, because like you, when you're in the jar, you can't read the label.
Yeah.
I think that's so true for so many people. So when I was in it, I didn't see any of this. So it's easy for me now. But now I've stepped out and I look back in, I honestly have my head in my hands a lot going, what the hell are we all doing?
Yeah.
How have we ended up in this situation?
Yeah.
Where 70% of our adult population are boozing for any excuse, and they're not being themselves. They're another big thing, ambition. I think it's like kryptonite to our dreams. I really believe that. I see it all the time. Mm. It puts a lid on your ambition. When you remove alcohol, I see this so often. Boom, ambition comes back.
Yeah.
These are the things I want to do. These are the goals that I want to achieve. It's massive.
It's a real awakening, because you really do see, it's hard because the whole narrative, and you can't speak for every country, but definitely here, is that you just don't belong. You're a foreigner. You're weird. You're odd. You're the odd one out. Living in California, where it's a health conscious place, it's the opposite. And my wife's Italian. It's the opposite. So it's really, if you can get out of the jar, like you said, to read the label, all of a sudden you go, what have I been doing? What is this?
What is it? And do you know, it's changing, which is really lovely. Yeah. So I mentioned I've got an 18-year-old. She's just gone to university. And I was worried, because through my lens, I was thinking, well, she's going to go to university. She doesn't really drink. And that's her choice. My wife drinks and I love her and I respect her. That's always been her choice. It's just not mine, right? And I think that's important in a relationship. I've got two daughters. I've never, ever said to them, don't drink. I haven't encouraged it. She chooses not to drink. She's a great athlete. She's off to university. And I thought, how's that going to pan out? Gone to university. She's thriving. Mm. She's in the running club. She's in all the dance clubs. She's doing all the nightclubs, right? But they're not just drinking in the way that we once did. Do you know what I mean? She is thriving in that environment. She's making friends left, right, and center. Whereas I think if you wound the clock back 20 years ago, she would have been the odd one out, and a bit, it would have been a bit strange. Whereas now it's becoming much more commonplace.
Why do you think now? Because there is a big movement now, and obviously you're a great part of it. Why do you think that's now?
I think awareness. I also think our phones. You know, when we grew up, everything we did, no one ever knew about is the truth of it, bar our friends that were there. And I can imagine it now. This is me more of a guest than anything scientific. But let's just say you're a young kid right now and you get drunk and do something silly in front of people. You could go to school the next day and every single person at school know what you did.
Yeah.
And not just them, your 2,000 other friends that you may have met at some point in your life might now know about it. That's got to be an unbelievable deterrent in some ways to not drink alcohol and do something messy like we've all done in our younger years. So I think that's part of it. I also think just awareness about health and vibrancy. There's definitely a disinterest in getting messy. Like, you know, when we were growing up, I looked to the adults and thought, that looks so cool. I want to do that.
Yeah.
Whereas I know, because I see it, I think our younger people are looking at the adults now and thinking, that's embarrassing.
Yeah, which is great.
The state of them.
Yeah.
Like, why am I going to get like that? I'm never doing that. It's changed. And alcohol-free alternatives are now everywhere. I saw a big thing in the Times just recently. Younger people were choosing to go to the gym on a Friday night rather than going to the pub.
Yeah, it's amazing.
They're getting bored of it. I mean, so I think there's a band of people, probably sort of 30 to 80, that big booze band that's sort of going to get flushed out eventually, if you know what I mean. So we're sort of nicely in the middle of that. So we've got plenty of work to do for the next few years.
And talking of work, dry with two Ys, I'm really interested about it. So our audience is global. So if they don't know what that is, Andy, what is dry?
Yeah, so on the back of that wonderful experience, I was just inspired to do something about it. I didn't know what I was going to do. That led to me writing a book, which was fab, starting a movement.
Two books, right?
Two books eventually, yeah, which was cool. And again, a bit like yourself, having left school at 16 and was diagnosed dyslexic and all those things, and hyperactive, I'd have had a different label now, I'm sure. It was nice to be able to go and do those things, right? Yeah. That's just a limiting belief again, like you discovered, a limiting belief that was saying, well, I can't write a book, I can't spell. Well, that's what editors are for. I've written two, and there's another one on the way. Started that movement, which I loved. And all of a sudden, what happened was with all that training as a coach, it just stepped me into this new arena of entrepreneurship, which has been a really lovely thing. So whilst I was running my brokerage all along the franchise 4 years ago, I stepped away from the city. My office just around the corner, my brokerage just around the corner. So 5 years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, I stepped away from there to do this full time, which is coaching and mentoring. I train coaches. It's a big part of what I do, life coaches, executive coaches. And one of the initiatives that came out of that, I trained a guy called Matt Pink as a coach. And he came out and said, I've got this great idea. I want to create a community online, an app, you know, and inspire a million people to change their relationship with alcohol. And he wrote it down on a piece of paper, D-R-Y-Y, dry. And I was like, that's it. That is cool. He's in fashion. He's cool. I'm not. So he sort of got that lovely, all the aesthetics of it. Yeah. It looked good. It feels great. Yeah, he knows what he's doing. I was like, I want to be a part of that. And so we ended up going into partnership to create the Dry app, online, offline community. There's live content in there every day. It's completely free. So wherever you get your apps from. And I feel so grateful for that movement now. It is changing people's lives on a daily basis. And a bit like the beautiful work that you're doing, I get that feedback all the time. I'll go to an event, we'll have a meetup, and people will come up in tears, embrace us. The app, the work that you're doing, the support that we get in there has changed my life. It's changed my family's life. That for me is the greatest buzz you'll ever experience in your life. Yeah. That's the thing that keeps me going, gets me out of bed. And I'm so excited. I just turned 50 the other day. And
congratulations for making it.
We made it. I'm more excited about the next 10 years than I were the last. I mean, how many people get to say that? I mean, it feels so rare. So yeah, I'm forever grateful for all the work that we're doing in the alcohol-free space, which is really exciting.
That's amazing. It's incredible. And I've been watching you for quite some time. I'm like, this guy is an advert for Duracell Bunny. I'm like, where does this enthusiasm, this energy come from? Have you always had that?
I think channeled in the right way. Again, like yourself, it used to be in football. So that's all I was ever going to do. And I had so much energy for that. And then it got channeled into being successful in business. And a lot of that involved drinking and whatnot. So I think I've just picked it up and pointed it in the right direction, but I think it comes back to meaning and purpose. What I was looking for was more meaning in my life. I knew there was more than just making money. I knew there was more. And I didn't know where to find that. And the great irony is, like so many people do, my biggest struggle ended up becoming my greatest gift. Stepping into that arena of inspiring people to transform their relationship with alcohol just filled me up, like lit me up. Bounce me out of bed every day. You know, I started all of those organizations while still in a full-time job effectively. And I sat down just recently and I always make my goals for 10 years. So I sat down to write my goals from 50 to 60. And I started to try and write lots of goals, all the classic-y sort of stuff, you know, Ironmans and all that jazz. And I thought, what would be my one goal? If I just had one goal, like this guiding light for the next 10 years, what would it be? And all that just kept coming up was inspire people to transform their relationship with alcohol.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all I'm going to do for the next 10 years in all its shapes and sizes, because it brings me meaning and purpose. It's adding value to the world. I'm in service of others. It's a contribution. I feel like I matter. I feel like I'm adding something to this short and precious planet of ours. And I'm just going to follow that adventure. And that's what I keep doing. And it lights me up with energy. So that's the secret.
It's so beautiful. What would you say to younger folk who are maybe slightly different from your daughter that are going to head towards the alcohol, a normal set of people that are just going to go and start drinking and stuff? What would you say to those guys?
I think experiment with going alcohol free. It's become so much easier to do that now. It doesn't have to be a forever thing.
Yeah.
And mine is not a forever thing, although it will be. It set out as a 28-day thing and I loved it. So I think as a younger person, experiment with not drinking. I never did that. There was no experiment. I just kept going all the time because I didn't know any difference. So what does it feel like for you to be alcohol free? And then always focus on the wins, not on, oh, it's going to be boring because all the lads are out or all the girls are out. They're all going to be drinking. I'm going to miss out. What are you gaining from it? Mm. Have you got more time, more energy? You better at your job? Are you more able to talk to boys and girls, whatever the setup is? Are you more able to form better relationships? Are you able to get up the next day and go biking or hiking? Are you hitting the gym? Are you getting in better physical shape? Mm. Focus on all the wins of that experience. And that in itself, I think, will tell you such a story. It might be, actually, I really enjoyed that. I'm going to do it more often than not. And it might be that tactically you take a break every now and again, or you just end up drinking a bit less, or some nights you don't drink, or whatever your setup is. I think that's the way to ease your way into it, rather than thinking, that's it, I can't drink again, you know, my life's doomed.
Yeah.
Just experiment. And if that experiment, like genuinely, I believe it's a superpower. Whatever you want to achieve in your life, if you want to go into traditional business, entrepreneurship, sport, if you take a break from alcohol, you'll be better at all those things. So if all those things are important to you, take a break and find out what that feels like.
Andy, just I mentioned marshmallows in the beginning because that's changed my life about marshmallows. Can you just explain what that is, please?
Yeah, so in my second book called Let's Do This, I write about this famous study that you may have heard, which is the marshmallow study. And this study really was from a guy called Walter Mischel. And what he did, he took children, preschoolers, they were about 6 or 7, and he placed a juicy marshmallow in front of them and then gave them an option. And the option was, I'm just going to pop out the room for a second. If by the time I come back in, you haven't eaten that marshmallow, I'll give you more marshmallows. So this was really just meant to be a test to see how children in particular dealt with the struggle of temptation. So they'd go into a two-way glassed room and watch the kids, and they'd step outside. But what they didn't tell the kids, they'd step outside for as long as 15 minutes. And then they'd watch them wiggle and squirm and distract themselves. And what they concluded from that research was that distraction was a really good technique. Mm. They parked the research, fast forward 10 years. Walter Mischel's daughter, who was in the original study, was 6, was now 16, 17, and going through the, I think it's the SATs, in America. And actually some of the kids that were also in that study were her friends, had all grown up together. And one day they started to notice that some of the same kids always seemed to be the ones that struggled with exams or always in trouble. And Mischel had this insight of, I wonder if we go back to that original study from when they were children, was there something in that that might actually influence how they behave now as teenagers? And lo and behold, it did. They found that those that were able to resist the marshmallows the longest were those that were more successful in their exams, for example. They then followed that through into their adult years and found that those that were most able to resist the marshmallows were more successful, earned more money, less likely to be incarcerated. So it created all this incredible insight around willpower, basically saying, if you've got willpower, you're, you know, doomed to a life of success. If you haven't, you're doomed. And I found this really interesting because I know I'd have eaten the marshmallows before they even left the room, right? So, and I'd done relatively well. So I was a bit like, how does that work? And then what I started to think was, well, is there another way to flip that script when it comes to marshmallows? Rather than having something you always have to resist to use willpower, what if you flipped the script and made it something proactive that you wanted that still took you towards your goal? So for example, in the alcohol, rather than trying to resist that using willpower, actually flip the script and think, what are the things that it's giving me, i.e. the marshmallows that it's giving me, that I want more than what I'm trying to resist? For example, it's going to give me better sleep. I want that. It's going to give me more energy. I want that marshmallow. It's going to give me more time. I want that marshmallow. It's going to give me better skin. I want that marshmallow. And by actually lining those marshmallows up and eating those marshmallows, because I know how to vet the marshmallows, there's no willpower required. And that, in a nutshell, for me, helped me start achieving some of those goals that I traditionally was finding difficult by trying to resist the temptation, as it were.
That's amazing. That's such a great way. When I read it, I was getting excited to read it because it's such an amazing way to look at things, because it's achieving, you're going towards, aren't you, instead of going away. Because willpower only works really when you really want it. So it just helps you in a lovely momentum, right?
And one thing about that, willpower runs out.
Yeah.
And this is the thing, willpower is like a metaphorical muscle. So the more you use it, the quicker it runs out. And this is why I think a lot of people fail to make change, because let's just say you've said, I'm going to go to the gym. And you've planned your gym at the end of the day. Your willpower tanks are very often depleted by a busy job or a stressful job or not telling the boss where to go. So by the time you think, shall I go to the gym tonight? There's no willpower there. I'll do it tomorrow. So it's learning how to manage that. Your willpower tanks, by the way, are more full in the morning. So if you have got a willpower challenge, put it in the morning. You're much more likely to do it. Yeah. Or as I describe, flip the script, put it into a frame where you want to do that thing. You're much more likely to do it.
Wonderful. I highly recommend that listeners read both your books, look at Dry, and we'll put all that on the links and everything after. So yeah, thanks, Andy. That's been amazing.
Top work.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholfer.